This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. Food writer Corby Kummer is here with me in Studio 3 to talk about our rights when it comes to eating out. He recently wrote about this for Vanity Fair in an article titled Tyranny, It's What's for Dinner. In this article, he asks, how did the diner get demoted from honored guest, whose wish was the waiter's command, to quivering hostage enthralled to the chef's iron whim? Corby, welcome back. So how did we get here?
The best part is watching you bop to the music before the segment. How did we get here? Chefs want to be artists. They want to be recognized as artists. And this is a wish I honor and delight in. I just don't want to be forced to eat all of their art at one time. There's a great line that my friend Barbara Kafka, wonderful food writer, said when I arranged for her to come to a Boston restaurant. And I told the chef, I'd already reviewed him so I could actually call the chef and say, this woman's coming in. I really would like you to give her a tasting menu. And she said, he didn't give me a tasting menu. He gave me a taste of the menu. So everything on it. And that's what chefs are doing these days. They're sort of making you eat everything they can come up with.
So we're talking about the fixed price menu. And I just want to be clear that what you're writing about, because you can go around to many restaurants and find fixed price menus. And sometimes you can have a choice of a fixed price menu or ordering off the menu. What you're talking about are restaurants that people crave to get into, mm-hmm. to taste the food of these top chefs who say, this is the multi-course meal you will eat. Period. And there will be no substitutions.
That's right. It's all or nothing. And the all is not the usual prefix or fixed price that we're used to, which is 4, 5, 6 courses. It's 12, 15, 18, 22 courses. The price, as has been pointed out to me by outraged chefs, and of course they were outraged by this, that was part of the whole fun of writing it, is they are hardly making money on this. Because there's so many ingredients that go into it. On the other hand, just giving everybody the same menu allows a chef a lot more control of costs because they're only ordering the food they know they will serve and will go out of that kitchen, which is something that other chefs who want to offer a big variety of things don't have the luxury of knowing. It's somewhat unpredictable. Also, chefs, I think, are going to start adopting the model of Grant Achatz, a brilliant chef in Chicago who can pull this off, unlike a lot of other chefs, who adopted the ticket, use it or lose it option, which is you go onto that website for his new restaurant next. 3 months beforehand, they'll start putting seats on sale. You buy for a certain night, you pay in advance, and if you don't show up, too bad, you've paid for your ticket. They've already got their revenues collected in advance. They're able to get away with it, and I have a feeling a lot of other chefs are eyeing that model and thinking, can I do it too?
Well, I think a lot of people are listening and saying, well, I don't know. Who are these chefs? I wouldn't pay for that. Well, you would if it's Thomas Keller or if it's some of the other great top chefs that you mentioned here.
I mean, or Grant Achatz, this guy in Chicago.
Because, you've heard about them. Chefs now are celebrities. You want to taste it. What I was puzzled by, because I didn't realize how long and how many servings now were happening at some of these restaurants. I happened to go to Thomas Keller's restaurant at French Laundry out in California some mm-hmm. years ago for lunch, and it was about 11 courses, very tiny servings, absolutely incredibly delicious, mm-hmm. but I didn't feel abused because I wanted it and I was there for lunch. But you describe 30 courses at dinner? That's crazy.
Yeah, no, it's really true. And at French Laundry, he would often do that number of courses at dinner. But something about Thomas, who's a real master chef, is he actually sort of knows the difference between lunch and dinner, a distinction that is blurring now at these tasting menu places. So I document in the Vanity Fair piece a tasting menu at 11 Madison Park that started at 1, and they were finally serving us the very last course at 10 to 6. And two young people at the table stayed until 7. And the best detail, I thought, was about 4 o'clock midway through the meal, which we'd expected to be over. They'd said 2.5 at least hours. But by 4 o'clock, 3 hours after we started at 1, we were barely over the halfway point. And a woman started coming out and passing to all the tables with their white tablecloths, carrying a steam iron, a cordless steam iron. She started ironing the tables around us. It was the oddest thing because it bled right into dinner service. Yeah. And one of the things they said was, when I made the reservation, there is no difference between lunch and dinner. It is the same menu. So they're going to that theatrical experience that people pay for. And because it's theatrical, it's really like coming out and spending a fortune on a musical. You know, it's out-of-towners who are coming in for a New York show. It's an experience. It's nothing a New Yorker would ever have time for.
Well, you know, let's let everybody know that we know this is a high-class problem. Except, I want to read this line in your piece that I think it speaks to the influence of this. For people who can go to all of these restaurants, that's one thing. And I think you raise a lot of pertinent issues. But it becomes more pertinent if this is a model that's bleeding over to other people. And I love this line. You say, as more and more restaurants adopt this model, tasting-only menus will empower formerly well-meaning, eager-to-please cooks and servers to become petty despots. And more diners will discover that absolute power irritates absolutely. So this is coming to a restaurant near you then. That's what scared me reading
this. Callie, I remember exactly where I dreamed up that line and how proud I was of it. I'm only surprised that it wasn't killed by editors who always know just what your favorite line is, and usually very justly. I'm an editor. Kill it. So I did love that line. I don't think it's a good trend if young – I do think it's a good trend for young ambitious chefs to – get a local following for their artistry. I am incredibly high on Tim Maslow at Striptease in Watertown.
Oh, me too.
I'm promoting him like everywhere in the country. You know, I love his stuff. It's just fascinating. It's new. It's innovative. He hasn't gone to a tasting menu yet. I have to say, I hope he doesn't, because I love getting to choose what I want to eat. But I'm always surprised. I'm always thrilled when I go there. There is room to surprise and thrill people while letting them have a choice of what they eat. Jose Andres, who's a friend and a very good restaurateur in Washington, gave this blistering interview that was really funny. He hated my piece. And said, you know, I lose money on my tasting menus. I pay a fortune for those ingredients. The staff-to-guest ratio is much higher than it is in my other restaurants. You want to order what you want, go to one of my other restaurants. Or another chef could just say, go to another restaurant. Don't come to mine. He said, I'm not putting a gun to your head. He said, you want me to serve you one dish a night? Pay me $5 million for the restaurant, and I'll cook you what you want, one dish a night. But I'm paying the overhead. It's my choice.
Well, I think there's something in between. But anyway, I thought your piece was very well done, and I hope it's not a trend that is taken up by other restaurants that I'm more likely to eat in.
Me too.
Let me point out I was at French Laundry one time, and one time only. Anyway, there's another interesting lot of stories being written about this, and that's the whole Coca-Cola backlash now. Mm-hmm. Coca-Cola, in trying to enter into the discussion about obesity, particularly in light of Mayor Michael Bloomberg saying we're going to tax this stuff, we're going to limit the size of sodas. This is ridiculous. Sodas, empty calories are the issue. And Coca-Cola decided, okay, we're gonna put ourselves in the conversation, and we're going to let you know that we know what you're talking about, but we have something to say. We have a little bit of a clip from an ad they're putting out that's being severely criticized. Let's listen.
Oh, good.
We now offer over 180 low and no calorie choices. And most of our full calorie beverages now have low or no calorie versions. Over the last 15 years, this has helped reduce the average calories per serving across our industry's products in the U.S. by about 22%.
So they're saying, hey, we know if you know, because they have another line in their ad that says, you know, calories will put weight on you. We know that. But we're doing our part. So it's not just, you know, we're not the mean guys here. We're not the bad people. We're a partner in the discussion about anti-obesity. No need to get rid of all the sodas. Just see where we're coming from. Severely criticized. What do you say?
Well, there's always an elephant in the room in the soda debate, and it is the shape of a very obese elephant. And that is the core products for both Coke and Pepsi are very highly sugared drinks with high fructose corn syrup, which are different from other calories. And they can't win for losing because they can never defend those core products. Those core products, more and more nutritionists are coming to say, do not belong in anyone's diet. They are not possibly a healthy component used in moderation of anyone's diet. Why? The current reasoning goes that because they don't give they don't send signals of satiety to the brain. 20 minutes after you have it, you don't automatically start regulating what you eat because you sort of feel full, the way you do with all the other calories. There's something that's not completely understood, but what they are now saying, even if they don't understand exactly why it bypasses the brain's signals for satiety, is it's not like any other form of consumption. You don't feel full. You don't register it as something you're eating. And so it's just packing on the pounds, as the New York City Health Department, in its horribly graphic, gloppy ads of showing big fat that you're drinking. It's just different from other things. Now, they took this, I think, pretty brave stand by trying to say, here's how many calories there are. We're even putting the number of calories proportion on the front of our bottle.
When you say they, you were talking about Coca-Cola.
Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. And everybody mm-hmm. said, oh, what do they think? Nobody can read the back? It's too knee-jerk and easy to criticize them for doing this. They are trying to say, you want to be aware of your calories? We know that mandatory menu labeling is coming down the pike. We know that everybody can't hide this anymore. Mm-hmm. So here's what the calories are. What they won't go as far as saying is, we shouldn't be making these core products. But on the other hand, Pepsi, which was the subject of a long Morning Edition piece just today, which got rid of its guy, Derek Yock, whom I get to be on a panel with tomorrow night, who was their longtime nutrition director. He had been on the outside of the World Health Organization saying fast food companies are evil. Then Pepsi brought him inside the tent. And he did try to get a lot of the divisions of Pepsi to lower the calories, the sodium, everything in their drinks. The problem is they're never going to stop making their core drinks. It's the source of their profit. They're publicly traded companies. They have to be reporting earnings. So I applaud them for developing low-calorie products. I hope they will aggressively market them. But when it comes to soda, it's a third rail.
And we should say, we're talking $17 billion industry. So, I mean, there's a reason why they have to try to protect the core product. Coca-Cola, by the way, has pointed out that they're making those little cans, so there's less of the calories that are not fulfilling. But they haven't taken the step to acknowledge that and agree with the nutritionists that say there's a different kind of calorie you get from a soda than from a hamburger. Both have some issues, but you just get more from a hamburger than you would from a soda. So there you
nutrition,
have
nutrition, for
right,
example.
Right, exactly. I want to quickly get you in to comment on the expansion of the food trucks here in Boston. I'm very excited about it.
So I somehow thought you were going to be excited by it, and I want to hear what food trucks you've been going to.
Well, I like any time they're not over on my side of the world most of the time, but I like the ones, and I love the one that serves banh mi. I just love it. I can't think of the name of it right now.
One that's called banh mi, B-O-N space M-E.
I think that's it. I've had that one, and I like the cheese one. I like the cupcake. I like food trucks.
I like having the choice. Isn't it neat to have things just come to you, or to be walking down a street and then suddenly you see something and you could just walk right up to the window? And it's kind of like when the Good Humor truck would come and the thing you most wanted to do was to have it stop and for you to have enough money in your pocket, which was very seldom, especially if like parents like mine did their very best to not let you have enough money to do anything. But now you can order whatever you want. So I've been knee-jerk myself in being against them because I think they take away business from bricks and mortar operations that have been spending a lot. But I have to say, Boston, under Edith Murnane, the food policy director, and Mayor Menino, who is a real hero of mine, have been more enlightened than other cities, really enlightened. So you have a pizza truck. You can't be within 300 feet of a pizza establishment that's paying rent. They also designated spots. And I didn't realize when I got my first ticket at 9 o'clock at night for parking in a food truck designated zone in the south end of Boston. I was actually doing a review meal. Well, there are food trucks after dark, right? It's a daytime business. I came back to a $70, $75 ticket outraged. What I didn't realize is these food trucks pay like $1,800 a month in rent to the city. It's a big revenue generator. On the other hand, the city's taking great care to allow them primo locations all through the city. And my terrifically outgoing and on-the-ball editor at Boston Magazine, Leah Menes, has a piece right now on the website about this trend that I think is the best trend, which is food trucks use this as an experimental lab. So it's $40,000 to $120,000 to start up a food truck, keep it going. it itself has its complications. You have to rent space in a commissary to make the food that you're then hauling around the city. You've got rent. But they're opening bricks and mortar locations once they realize it's a success. I think that's terrific, including your favorite, Banh Mi.
Yeah, and Clover, too, is coming
Oh, Clover's got two. I've been to the one in Harvard Square.
I know, me too. All right, well, I'm loving them all. I love the high-end restaurants. I love the food trucks. I love it all, and I love Corby Cummer. Thank you, Corby.
Thank you, Callie.
Senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine and restaurant critic for Boston Magazine. And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. I'm Callie Crossley. Have a great and hopefully not snowy afternoon.